All Our Tomorrows Come Today by Flippy Spoon, read by Cookie Mom 6067. Chapter 1. James T. Kirk bit back a smile as Ensign Fowles continued to vent. "Believe me, I'm very excited. It's very exciting. This has been my first time witnessing a first contact, after all. My first contact. I'm just saying, the Bluvians made first contact with us, the Farragut. I don't see why the Enterprise has to get involved with these negotiations." Kirk exchanged a knowing look with Captain Lupo. He tugged on the hem of his uniform, standing stick straight in the transporter room as they waited for the Enterprise Federation flagship welcome wagon. "Just the way it works, Fowles. Starfleet sends the flagship whenever possible for this kind of diplomatic mission to usher a new planet into the Federation. Don't take it as a slight. We'll still make the history books." Lupo turned to look at Kirk, her thick gray dreadlocks draped regally around her shoulders, and her deep brown eyes were warm but observant as she nudged his shoulder. "Don't think I haven't noticed you're as excited to see your friends on the Enterprise again as you are for this mission." Kirk raised his hands in a gesture of surrender. "I will not stand for accusations of disloyalty, Captain. But yes, I have been looking forward to this. The Enterprise crew is a fascinating bunch." Kirk clasped his hands behind his back, quelling the inward sting he felt when he remembered that difficult conversation with La'an and the hurt in her eyes when he had to let her down easy. All that, and yet things with Carol still weren't exactly smooth sailing. By his calculations, they were on the outs for the third time in as many weeks. Carol made noises about not wanting him in her life, or the life of her child at all, though she couched it in gentler language. They would only stand in each other's way, she insisted. A part of him agreed and was ashamed of agreeing. But he wasn't about to go crying to La'an about any of this. He'd immediately read her as a very sensitive person. He wouldn't jerk her around just because his relationship with Carol wasn't turning out as he'd hoped. And anyway, he wasn't convinced she had feelings for him so much as she'd shared a connection with a completely different Kirk that he could never be. "Their science officer especially interests me," Lupo said, as if making a tentative confession. "Half human, half Vulcan. That can't be easy. I'll bet his perspective on relations to newly discovered life forms is unique." "Oh, yes, Spock." Kirk blinked, as if only just remembering the Vulcan existed. "He's friendly, in his way. Extraordinary intellect, exemplary officer from what I can tell, but I haven't gotten to know him well yet." "Four beaming in from the Enterprise, sir," the transporter room chief chirped behind them. Kirk cleared his throat and stood yet straighter. "Look lively, gents," Lupo said. The transporter chimed and Pike, Chin Riley, Spock, and Uhura appeared. Pike stepped down and Lupo stepped forward, smiling warmly. "Captain Pike," Lupo said, "welcome to the Farragut. We're happy to have the Enterprise with us on this auspicious occasion." "Nothing better than this kind of mission. Congratulations on the first contact, Captain Lupo." Pike rubbed his hands together as if anticipating a sporting event, and Kirk couldn't help bouncing on his toes a little. The enthusiasm was infectious. This was the essence of Starfleet. This made all the hardest work worth it. "To be a part of it is truly our pleasure, Commander Kirk," Spock said in his typically stiff manner. "It is good to see you again." "Yes, for once I get to be the one offering the Farragut's hospitality." He sent Spock a wink and felt a spark of amusement when the Vulcan responded with the slightest quirk of his eyebrow. "Ensign Uhura, Commander Chin Riley." Handshakes and pleasantries went all around, and Lupo led the contingent to the conference room for a quick debriefing on the Bluvians. The Bluvians are what some among the Federation higher-ups privately referred to as an A1 get, Lupo spoke crisply, hands folded on the conference table. The Bluvians' leader, Representative Gonorana, appeared on the view screen, Gonorana, like all Bluvians, was a deep orange color with faint scales around their snout that rippled out into a beard under their chin and behind their ears. Their big amber eyes looked back at Kirk. And if Kirk were asked to read character from a portrait with no further information, he would have guessed that Gonorana was highly intelligent and hopeful, if perhaps stern. Bluvians are peaceful. Their world is not a utopia by any means. They have their territorial skirmishes and criminal activity like anyone else, but they prioritize relationships between each other and others much more highly than they do conquest or the attainment of profit. This is their primary value. A century ago, this race collectively chose to focus on science as a means of promoting this value. This led to their space program and more recently to their development of a warp drive. They profess to admire the Federation, but have shown a healthy amount of wariness about joining. Due diligence is always a relief to see in a new entry to the Federation, Pike said with a chuckle. Any alien race that's a little too enthusiastic without asking questions. Doubtless has skeletons in the closet, Kirk finished for him. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Spock's quizzical expression. Dark secrets, that is, in one's history. I have heard the idiom, Spock said. I was thinking of how hesitant the Vulcans once were to ally with humanity and all its attendants and relatively recent skeletons in the closet. Touché, Kirk said with a snort. Not as humorless as I recall, Kirk thought. Captain, Spock went on, I have been curious whether the proximity of the temporal anomaly in this sector has had a significant effect on the technological development of the Bluvians, or on their culture generally. So have I, Lupo lit up like a candle and leaned forward, tapping the table's console and bringing up a projection of the planet Bluvis. The dossier was vague on this point. Certainly there's no record of time travel activity, for which I think we can all be grateful. However, there is an interesting ore native to Bluvis, similar to neutronium, but it has temporal properties. They once commonly used it in ceremonial rites. Now, however, it is more heavily regulated, and the ore is very rare. We may get to see an example of it, actually. We'll be touring their Museum of Science and Cultural History at the Capitol in Endovid. I wonder if they ever use this ore for industrial purposes, Pike said. Although depending on the degree of temporal activity, they may have considered it to do more harm than good. Can you give us a better idea of their system of government? Kirk was quickly absorbed in the conversation. His posture was casual, leaning on his wrist, absently stroking his chin. But it wasn't until he noticed Spock staring at him he realized he was smiling widely. Too widely. His left hand incessantly tapping the table with two fingers. He stopped under the scrutiny and sat back, folding his hands in his lap instead, and frowned. Spock looked away. This guy must think I'm a maniac, Kirk thought. Sam's nutty brother. Spock and Kirk had not talked at length much on the Enterprise beyond pleasantries and banal chit-chat, but now Spock was on Kirk's turf. Suddenly he was slightly self-conscious, another feeling he wasn't especially used to. He always got giddy on these kinds of missions, or any kind of mission that wasn't obviously dangerous. Not that he didn't take things seriously. Quite the opposite. It was the sheer sense of relish he felt at the challenge of exploration, the fire of joy that burned in him at the very thought of discovery. He still wasn't used to it. He wondered if he would ever get used to it. He hoped not. Still, the reserved stare of the Vulcan made him feel silly for acting like a little kid about it. Jim refocused. His job was to be agreeable and charming to anyone he met on Bluvis and to answer any questions they had about Starfleet and the United Federation of Planets. Uhura and Fowles were there to learn and would likely stick close to the captains. The negotiations were for Pike, Lupo, and also Number One to handle. Spock, Kirk assumed, would be in Kirk's lane, and therefore probably end up accompanying him around Endovid. Well, this would be interesting. The debriefing ended, and they beam down to the planet, arriving, always a little awkwardly, especially to populated planets unused to transporters, on the front steps of Indovid's Capitol Hall. The collected crowd was modest, but old-fashioned cameras pointed at them from every direction as Representative Gennara waddled up to them. They wore a well-tailored black coat and tie. Kirk had seen enough at this point that a bipedal lizard wearing a handsome coat, their orange tail trailing behind them, only made him blink. Introductions, welcomes, a clicking sound from the Bluvians that was the equivalent to applause, bows, camera flashes. Lupo sent Kirk to tour the Museum of Science and Cultural History with Spock. Kirk accepted the order with a curt nod and turned on his heel in Spock's direction, hoping the Vulcan did not in fact think he was a huge weirdo. Kirk caught Spock's eye and smiled a little tightly without his usual ease. He found himself wanting to impress this man. He wasn't sure if it was because Spock had such a strong reputation and because Sam was so impressed by him, or just because there was something about Spock. Perhaps he was overthinking, and he should have eaten a bigger breakfast. "It's because you think you weirded him out for half a second, and you want everyone to be impressed by you," Kirk thought, mildly disappointed at how obvious the answer was. "He's just an ordinary half-Vulcan. He's also ridiculously good-looking." "Commander Kirk," Spock said, matching Kirk's gait beside him as he followed their Bluvian guide to the museum. "I wanted to speak to you. I hope I did not make you uncomfortable today during the debriefing." "Uncomfortable?" Kirk's ears perked up. "You caught me staring for a moment," Spock explained. "It seemed to cause you unease." "Trust a Vulcan to plunge right into the awkwardness instead of skirting it." It was kind of refreshing, although the naked directness with which he approached dissecting such a minor social interaction, just in case it had caused Kirk the mildest distress, was so keenly empathetic of him, and not what Kirk would have expected at all. "Oh, I wasn't..." Kirk licked his lips and decided to honor Spock's honesty and kind. "No, I was, yes, but you did nothing wrong. I imagined you thought I was acting strangely myself. I get pretty swept away when it comes to missions like this. I suppose I'm enamored with exploration." He grinned and turned to see Spock's tilt of the head, the quirk of a brow that was already becoming familiar, the moment of contemplation approaching a quiet delight when presented with something new. "Enamored," Spock repeated the word. "That is poetic of you, Commander." "Would you mind calling me Jim?" Kirk patted him on the shoulder. "Only been a first officer a few months. Takes some getting used to. Feels so stiff in casual conversation." "Jim," Spock said lowly, and Kirk felt the rumble of Spock's voice saying his name in his blood. "Damn. In fact, I did not think you were acting strangely, per se," Spock said, "but I did enjoy observing your reactions to Captain Lupo's presentation. You are quite expressive, even for a human. I have a habit of observing my colleagues' behaviors, especially those whom I do not yet know well." "Now, you can't mean to say your own crew isn't just as expressive as I am," Kirk countered. He reminded himself to look at the scenery around him once in a while, at the towering cathedrals and spiraling towers of Indovid, amongst more utilitarian structures and lavender-blossoming orchards. But it was also difficult not to keep watching Spock. For all his reserve, he was constantly registering the subtlest micro-expressions. Jim wondered what they all meant. Did the rest of Spock's crew know all their meanings? How long did that take to learn? He was pretty sure he'd already cataloged 4 different eyebrow raises. "They are indeed," Spock allowed. "Christine, Nurse Chapel, that is, she is something close to effervescent in her passion for the medical field. Ortegas appears to be chasing life's meaning itself when she accomplishes a complex bit of flying. I have noted that for humans, an enthusiasm for their work is as desirable a quality as competence. That is likely why they have found themselves on the crew of Starfleet's flagship." Kirk glanced down at his shoes and swallowed the twinge that came with Spock's assessment. It felt like a dig, even if Spock did not intend it that way. After all, he was not on the Enterprise. Just the youngest first officer in history, Kirk thought wryly. But it's not the Enterprise. He could practically hear Sam snickering somewhere. And then Spock went on, "But the way you are expressive is different." They stopped walking and Spock blinked at him at a loss for words. Kirk didn't imagine this happened often. The Vulcan looked vaguely alarmed about it himself. They had reached the museum, a curving crystalline structure. Their guides waited for them patiently, their scaly beards rippling. They should have been talking to the guides all this time. These were vital negotiations for the entry of a new people to the Federation, and Kirk couldn't stop chatting up the Enterprise's hot science officer. "Great job, Jim." "Different," Kirk said. "In what?" "You twinkle," Spock said. "I twinkle?" Kirk could not contain his grin. He could not recall the last time he was hit on so intensely. Maybe not ever. "Yes," Spock gestured at Kirk's face. He was standing close enough that Kirk wondered if those pretty ears could hear the quickening of his heart rate. "Yes, like that. You are doing it right now. There is a sparkle in your eye I have not seen in expressions of sheer delight in any other human. You are quite charismatic. Coupled with your undeniable intelligence and drive, I can see how you have already achieved first officer at your age." "Ah, well, thank you." Kirk's fingers tingled. He started up the front steps to the museum and stopped again, facing Spock. "I should tell you I'm seeing someone," Kirk sputtered. "Well, sort of. Not really. It's complicated." A fifth type of eyebrow raise. Bafflement. "I think you mean romantically. That is a non sequitur." "Is it?" Kirk heard his own voice pitch up a couple of octaves, but he couldn't help laughing a little. "You've been coming on to me, haven't you? Aggressively." Spock was utterly monotone when he said, "No, I was not. This has only been my honest assessment." "Oh." Every bit of blood in Kirk's body felt like it had rushed from his dick up to his cheeks. He cleared his throat. "I suppose I should take the compliment instead of being embarrassed, then. Well, all right, we've certainly ignored the Bluvians long enough. Lupo would have my hide." Kirk spoke in a rush and brushed past Spock to catch up with the endlessly patient Bluvians, who were content enough to talk amongst themselves while the Starfleet officers flirted each other to death. "I must apologize. We've been very rude. Can you tell us how long Indovid has been the capital? I would also love to know anything about the development of your architecture. It is not what I would have expected, but it is quite beautiful." Spock followed his lead as gracefully as if it were all according to a plan. For every remark from the Bluvians, he had a substantive response. But neither was he showing off, careful to ask good questions and listen to Jim's thoughts without interruption. Whereas Kirk's biggest problem was stowing away questions and comments and stories that came to mind as Spock spoke. Nearly everything he said reminded Kirk of something else that he thought might interest Spock, but which wouldn't be relevant at all to the Bluvians. It was a little annoying. In the museum, the Bluvians took them through the exhibits portraying their prehistory up to the dawn of their civilization. A corridor of animated holographics led out to a portico and a sculpture garden, where they were left to contemplate some of the greater works of Bluvian art. "You seem especially taken with their philosophy." Kirk came up beside Spock, who studied a Bluvian nude cut into a bas-relief wall. They collectively agreed to stop their pursuit of advancement in temporal mechanics because they knew they were not ready. They believed it was not worth potentially bringing greater harm to each other and their world. That shows an admirable amount of self-knowledge for a people. Vulcan will like them. Vulcans value the interest of the collective more than the self, the individual. Acting out of self-interest is illogical, Spock said. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. Something about this sentiment brought the Farragut disaster and the death of his former captain to Kirk's mind suddenly and brutally. Self-sacrifice. It was something he thought about a lot. It was something he'd obsessed about so much after that tragedy, he could hardly function. He went from imagining himself over and over firing in time and saving the crew to imagining himself bodily saving them somehow at the price of his own life, thinking how he would do so now, happily. The constant mantra in his head, it should have been me. Why wasn't it me? It must have all shown on his face. Spock said, Commander Kirk, are you well? Just an unpleasant memory. He managed a quivering smile. Grief sneaks up on you sometimes. It does. Spock frowned, perhaps thinking of some private grief of his own. He allowed the quiet to dwell between them instead of pushing Kirk on it, and he found himself grateful for the kindness just as he realized Spock had doubtless read his file. He knew about the Farragut, and he knew better than to ask. Spock, he was about to ask if Spock wanted to get a drink and play a few rounds of chess once they were back on board, and just as quickly, he second-guessed himself. He'd been lonely lately, and the shine of his promotion was already wearing off, and things weren't working out with Carol, and maybe he was feeling overly vulnerable with the Farragut coming to mind and seeing more with this cute Vulcan than was there at all. We have something special we would like to show you. The elder Bluvian, a professor from the Capitol's university, approached them, their eyes bright with excitement. If you'll follow us, please. Kirk's switch flipped abruptly. He smiled, and all at once he was the charming Starfleet officer again. But the promise of a special curiosity from this alien race was already filling him with some excitement. He could feel Spock's questioning gaze, wondering what Kirk had been about to say. The Bluvians led them to one of the museum's private libraries, where a couple of quiet Bluvians were bent over giant tomes and tablets at long tables. Kirk and Spock quietly followed the professor to a pedestal where a bright blue gem sat atop a white pillow. It appeared to glow faintly, but Kirk wasn't sure if that was just the way the light hit it. This is a unification stone. The professor picked the stone up and held it for them to see more closely. You may hold it. It is inactive. Inactive, Kirk repeated. Am I right in thinking this stone has temporal qualities? Exactly so. In our ancient days, this stone was used in marriage ceremonies. The two betrothed would hold the stone together as they took their vows, and here I can show you two. The Bluvian maneuvered Kirk and Spock to face each other and drew their hands together, encompassing the stone. Like this. You are certain this stone is inactive, Spock said. The Federation has strict rules governing temporal activities. Certain, yes, unless... Their lizard eyes blinked at them. Are the two of you lovers? That could make a difference. No, Spock said simply. Not yet, Kirk said, and tossed Spock a wink. He is being facetious. Unfortunately, Kirk thought. I'm sorry, Kirk said, chuckling. We're only acquaintances, actually. We serve on different ships. Please go on, Professor. Ah, yes, so the betrothed couple would both hold the stone in their hands as they spoke their vows, you see? And thus the stone would show them their future together, for good or ill. Every triumph and disaster, and even so many ordinary days throughout their life together. This shared vision created a connection for the couple to start their marriage with. It was an intensely intimate experience. It showed them their actual future, Spock said. Not just a potential future. Not something their minds perhaps created and... No, their true future, the professor said. Now, sometimes a couple decided not to go through with the ceremony after all, based on what they had seen. Not every story ended happily. Doesn't it rather, spoil the surprise, Kirk said. The professor had placed the stone in Spock's palm and Kirk's hand on top of it, and Spock's skin felt unexpectedly warm and soft next to the cold hardness of the stone. Knowing their futures, I mean. Ah, you see, the memories the stone gave them were only temporary, the professor said. After a couple of weeks, the memories faded. All this knowledge of the future forgotten. They were forbidden to write the memories down or to tell anyone what they had seen, beyond discussing it between each other, of course. That part was very important. It gave them a window to show them the life they would share with their partner, and whether every sadness and word spoken in anger was worth every joy. Then, once the memories were forgotten, they still knew they had chosen each other with open eyes, even if they no longer knew what was to come. Spock murmured, "Remarkable. Professor, Kirk opened his mouth to ask Spock what the matter was. The Vulcan's eyes were wide and stared fixedly at Jim, who found himself unable to move, and now noticed an uncomfortable heat coming from the stone, fitted between their palms and interlocking fingers. He wanted to yank his hand back, and couldn't move. He couldn't understand what the professor was saying, and neither could he speak. Commander, he heard Spock say in his mind, I do not think this stone is inactive. Not for us, apparently, Kirk thought back. Everything was disappearing around them, or maybe Kirk's eyes were slipping shut, he wasn't sure. But it seemed like Spock's voice in his head became gossamer, and he could see his words written in calligraphic silver in the peach clouds over Indovid. But we are not lovers. Chapter 2. Their newly minted captain, James T. Kirk, is sitting in the mess hall alone when Spock and Uhura find him. It was Uhura's idea to go looking for the captain, though Spock had noticed his exit from the party in the first place, and before that he noticed that Kirk's smile wasn't reaching his eyes like it usually did. He wondered if the gathering wasn't as decadent as Kirk might have been expecting, but after all, Kirk's ascension to the chair happened quickly, as so many of them often did in these emergency scenarios. The good parties usually came from intra-ship promotions following a captain's retirement or a move to an admiralty. Spock supposed Kirk might be comforted that Pike himself anointed him once he could communicate, but everyone knew Pike's new life was proving to be a difficult adjustment. Uhura pulled him aside and said, Our captain is missing from the party. I'm sure he has mixed feelings. He knows Chris. Perhaps we should leave him to himself, Spock said. He may want to be alone. You might be right, Uhura said, nudging him through the crowd in the port galley and toward the exit. The party was pleasant but low-key, not the kind of throwdown the crew sometimes enjoyed. But I doubt it. Let's go find him. Captain Kirk has a full drink in front of him. He is staring at the drink and not the incredible view of a nebula through the viewing window. This alone is worth some concern. Spock has noted that if Kirk has the expanse of space in his line of vision and isn't looking at it, he might be upset about something. Sir, Uhura stands next to the table. Kirk has not acknowledged their entrance in the mess. Your absence has been noticed. I'll return shortly, Lieutenant, Kirk says. He smiles stiffly, no twinkle at all. He doesn't look at Spock. Just needed a bit of air. Spock does not point out that the air in the mess is exactly the same recirculated and conditioned air as the air in the port galley. Even considering the larger crowd at the party, the ship's systems would recalibrate accordingly. Humans love to say they need some air when they are overwhelmed in social situations. Spock is reminded that it was Uhura who first introduced him to the captain back when he was on the Farragut. It is a pleasing memory, perhaps made bittersweet in context. To the casual observer, sir, Spock says, it would appear you are perhaps not as celebratory as the occasion calls for. Kirk frowns at him, leaning on his hand. You don't look celebratory either, Mr. Spock.
I am never celebratory.
He deliberately puts a little extra dryness on the comment, and Kirk rewards him with a chuckle and a genuine smile this time.
I'll return to the party shortly, Kirk says again. I promise.
Uhura nods, knowing she's been dismissed. She glances at Spock, and getting nothing from him because he's not giving anything, she shrugs to herself and leaves the mess.
Kirk, Spock surmises, has already and wisely entered captain mode. He is clearly upset. Spock suspects he is very upset. He will not open up to the crew, and that is understandable. But Spock is his XO. And humans, Spock has long ago learned, have to talk about their messy feelings to someone at least occasionally, or their brains eventually short-circuit. Perhaps because they absolutely refuse to meditate, in Spock's experience. The last thing the Enterprise needs is their brand new and still young captain short-circuiting.
Spock stays right where he is and regards the captain, who raises both eyebrows and shrugs.
Do you need something, Mr. Spock?
I do not know, but I suspect that your life's ambition has been the captain's seat, likely that of this ship in particular. Yet now that you have it, you think you do not deserve it due to the manner in which you obtained it.
Kirk blinks at him. You sure you're only half human?
Admittedly, my hypothesis is not arrived at independently.
That's as much as he's willing to say about how much the captain's emotional state has been spoken of by the crew.
Of course, none of it is logical.
Ah, there it is.
Captain Pike would not want you to feel guilt for this accomplishment, Spock says, and I know him better than you do.
Kirk takes all this in.
He takes a sip of his highball, squinting at Spock.
The crew... I have not spoken to a single crew member who is unhappy that you were chosen to succeed, Captain Pike, with the exception of Ensign Starling, but his taste has always been questionable, and he plays chess very poorly.
Kirk stares at Spock for several beats, and abruptly he stands, knocks back the rest of his drink, and slaps his hands on the table.
All right.
Spock translates that as a resolution of his upset feelings, and is proven correct when Kirk nods toward the door.
Let's get this party started. I've heard Lieutenant Uhura can really knock out a tune. Is this accurate?
She has a lovely singing voice, Captain. Would you like me to accompany her on the lute?
Kirk grins at him, hazel eyes sparkling madly. You play the lute?
Come on, Spock.
No.
Just tell me some of the words, a few lines. There was something about you having devilish ears.
I have forbidden Lieutenant Uhura from repeating her performance. I cannot stop you from requesting the lyrics from her directly.
But it's so much better coming from you.
That is my concern, Captain.
Spock stands outside the captain's quarters, inexplicably uncertain. Spock and his captain have a standing date, as Kirk likes to call it, for chess and a drink on Wednesday nights in the officer's lounge, or rather Kirk usually has a drink, and Spock has tea. But it is Wednesday night, and nearly a half hour beyond their usual meeting time. Ordinarily, Spock might let the matter drop and assume the captain is not up to it, or has forgotten, except that Kirk has never not been up for it, and is not the type to forget. But more significantly, though Spock does not like to admit it to himself, he is restless and anxious for the captain's company after the stress of taking Pike to Talos IV and explicitly committing mutiny. That Kirk has not held it against him so far is not especially surprising. It only validates what Spock knows about Kirk. Spock buzzes Kirk's door and waits. The captain takes so long that Spock wonders if he has fallen asleep, although it is still early and Kirk isn't exactly known for his healthy sleeping habits. Kirk is still in his uniform, his hair awry.
Captain, Spock says, did you forget our standing appointment?
Ah, Kirk nods, not quite meeting his eyes.
I didn't forget. Honestly, Spock, I wasn't sure our appointment would stand or anything outside of work, really, given what just transpired with Pike. Given what just transpired. There it is. Certainly he attempted to help Pike the way he knew Pike truly wanted to be helped. He tried to find the most logical possible solution to both problems. Still, he cannot deny it. He betrayed Jim. If Jim doesn't forgive him, Spock can hardly blame him. What is surprising is this reaction, given how Kirk, as was his habit, made a light joke at Spock's expense right after Pike went to Talos IV and all was revealed. In Spock's experience with Kirk so far, a joke means everything is okay. Status quo. Apparently not. The wave of unaccountable gloominess that rolls through Spock is startling, but he keeps himself composed. I understand, Captain. In fact, I would completely understand if you wish to have me transferred to a different ship. Oh, Jesus, of course you think. I'm not mad at you. You acted utterly selflessly to help a friend and to protect your captain the only way you could at the same time. I already admired you, Mr. Spock. Now I must accept that you're simply extraordinary. The gloom clears. Spock is warmed by Kirk's speech. Then, Captain, I admit I am confused as to why this means we cannot play chess and partake in the casual exchange of chatter you find so important, just as we do every Wednesday. If one thing had gone wrong, Kirk shakes his head. They are still hovering around his door, and Spock subtly steps inside the captain's quarters, allowing the door to shut behind them. It simply won't do for some passing yeoman to hear the captain so openly emotional. If Chris had refused, after all, or if Mendez had not agreed to the exchange with Talos IV, or if... You could have been executed, Spock, and... I said you were guilty. In a court-martial that was not, in fact, happening at all, Captain. But I thought it was. I thought it was real, all of it. I failed to trust you. Christ, I declared you guilty of mutiny. Sir, I was guilty of mutiny. But, sir, if I am understanding you correctly, you feel a keen sense of guilt that you have wronged me. I can assure you, you have not. But if you would like to atone for this perceived offense, I would be happy to offer you penance. Finally, Kirk's hunched-up shoulders relax, and he offers a wry smile. And what is my penance? Spock gestures to the door. Please come to the officer's lounge with me to play chess, have your drink, and share inane gossip about the crew I assuredly did not ask for. Well, if that's what it takes, Commander. You're pacing. Bones is on his third cocktail. I don't believe I've seen you pace before. He's fine, Spock. Have a mint julep. He is in distress. It's true that Spock is pacing. He can't seem to stop moving around the limited space of the sick bay. He is acting erratically, and he will not tell me his thinking. The captain is in distress, and he snapped at me. Spock could not keep his eyes off the captain back on the bridge as he turned it on for the actress who acted like she was doing the seducing when she was clearly being seduced for some mysterious cause beyond the usual. Hey, Spock, McCoy says. I don't suppose you remember that time we all thought you were committing treason, and then it turned out you had a good reason. This was just a few weeks ago, as a matter of fact. I did not want to involve the captain or crew in my actions, in case I was called in front of a court-martial. Well, I'm sure Jim has his reasons. But he is upset. He makes another round circling the doctor's desk. I have rarely seen him so upset. Doesn't seem upset to me, Bones shrugs. Seems fine. When you are adept at veiling your own emotions, you become adept at recognizing that skill in others. You're not veiling much now, Bones mutters, clucking around like a chicken with your head cut off. Spock narrows his eyes. You are not helping. I'm sure all will be revealed in the fullness of time. but he is in distress. Jim can't sleep, so Spock doesn't sleep. They are opposite each other in the otherwise deserted officer's lounge, a half-ignored chess game between them, and a second finger of whiskey in front of the captain. Jim has not yet pointed out that Spock has 3 hours until the beginning of his shift, and for this Spock is only grateful. Maintaining that he will go to bed when the captain goes to bed would only be tedious, and even with his Vulcan stamina, he is too exhausted for such an argument. It has been a difficult day. "Strange," Jim murmurs, staring at his unmoved knight. "I truly believe we made the correct choices all around, given the information we had. The crew, you saving our asses, we did everything right, but I can't shake this feeling of dissatisfaction." Everything is on the tip of Spock's tongue, but he has come to recognize what Kirk wants in this sort of mood, and it's not to hear about how great he is. "You were brilliant in command against a brilliant opponent. You defended me, and I will not forget it. You keenly feel the struggles experienced by your crew, and it hurts you, but it might make you a better captain." The last one is a recent epiphany that he finds himself wrestling with, like one of the riddles Sarek gave him when he was a child that took him weeks to untangle. "You liked him," Spock says simply. "The Romulan." Kirk gazes at him from across the chessboard, light bouncing from knight to rook and into the captain's sharp hazel eyes. "Is it wrong that I somehow feel as much grief for him as I do for the crewman we lost? It won't leave me alone. I grieve for our enemy. Funny that." "I do not believe it is wrong," Spock says. "I do believe it is quite human. And I do not intend that as an insult." "For once," Jim smiles, and this is reward enough for the sleepless morning to come. "For a second there," Jim says, "I was about to murder Bones." This is a surprise to Spock, who can't help but register it as such. They were reminiscing about Sam. Sometimes Spock thinks nothing brings him closer to the manner in which humans feel their emotions than grief. "Or almost nothing," he amends, watching the starlight play on Jim's eyelashes. They are alone together on the observation deck, watching the expanse go by. "I don't want to talk to anyone right now," Kirk murmured as they rode the turbolift. "Just you and me, okay? I can't stand to look at anybody else. I keep seeing Sam everywhere." Then he was quiet for so long that Spock had to reconcile a familiar insecurity. Surely the captain should want to talk to someone who understood human grief in a way he could not. And then Jim said, "Tell me about Michael." So Spock told Jim about Michael Burnham, backwards and forwards, and inevitably tripped into spilling the truth about what really happened to the Discovery, maybe because the seriousness of that secret seemed so far away, or because he was concentrating so hard on getting a smile out of Jim. Just that wistful little smile Jim allows when he is sad would be enough. "I thought it was something like that," is all Jim said about it. "She told me to find the person farthest from me," Spock said, "someone very unlike me, and to reach out for them." Jim thinks about that for a while, and then says, "For a second there, I was about to murder Bones." "I have certainly had the thought myself," Spock says, as that is a guaranteed smile from Jim, "but I am surprised to hear it from you." Kirk shakes his head again. He is teary from all the talk about Sam and Michael and wipes his eyes with the cuff of his sleeve. "When he blinded you, when he told me it was an accident with the light. Now, I know you would have learned to live with that and adapted, but in that moment, I thought he hurt you, truly hurt you, and I wanted to throw him out the airlock." He takes a drink of brandy, looking surprised at himself. Spock can't sum up a joke about how pleasing it would be to see McCoy go out the airlock, not least because the doctor felt bad enough about what had transpired and wept with relief when Spock regained his sight. He can't think of any response at all. Michael would have liked him, he thinks, and wonders if this is exactly who she was talking about. Jim can't stop laughing. Spock clasps his hands in front of him and watches the captain's knees give as he doubles over, reaching out to hold on to Spock's arm for support, his thumb resting against Spock's wrist. Spock gets a glimpse into Jim's mind, though it is too slight a connection for any specific thoughts. Joy, amusement, an explosion of warm affection in Spock's direction. "Your face!" Jim gasps, wiping a tear from his eye. He guffaws once again. Spock only raises his eyebrows. "I do not see the comedic value in my allergic reaction." "I didn't know your face could do that." Jalapeno clearly does not agree with me, though I am not aware of any Vulcan-specific allergies. "Your ears were quivering." Finally, Kirk's laughter fades. He squeezes Spock's arm, tossing off a grin that has gained infamy across the galaxy. "I've never seen anything like it." "I do not believe my ears quivered, sir." "I have several witnesses," Kirk insists, finally composing himself. "If necessary, I will convene a hearing on the matter, Mr. Spock." "Then I suppose I am at your mercy, Captain." The quip is dry as a bone, but inwardly Spock can only think about Jim's hand still resting on his arm. Shipwide upgrades at the station nearest Vulcan lead Spock to take the opportunity of a 2-week fellowship to speak amongst other notable scientists at a conference. He will also have the chance to visit his mother. If he has mixed feelings about any of this, Jim doesn't hear about them. He finds Spock impossible to read on this point, and as much as Spock insists he is anathema to emotion, Kirk has found it pretty easy to gauge when he is in true logical mode and when he is completely faking it. Yet when it comes to a visit to Vulcan, he is a brick wall, and then he is gone. 1424 days without the science officer who has become Jim's constant companion. He feels rather like he's loaned out both arms and half his brain. Meanwhile, McCoy is learning about medical advancements on a planet Jim has already forgotten the name of. There is no good-natured, snarky commentary to distract him, so Jim plays cards with Uhura. It has been 4 days that feel like 40. They are well within the borders of Federation space, and there is nothing to do other than a few administrative tasks that require little of the captain. He has already read 5 newly translated Andorian novels and beaten the computer at chess a couple dozen times. He has read up on the finest details of every new species, sentient or not, that they have come across so far this year. He is bored. And Spock isn't here, and he has known for a long time now that his feelings for Spock go well beyond what usually lies between captain and first officer, and he is certain he will lose his mind before these 2 weeks have ended. "Captain," Uhura says, "your head is not in the game." "Sorry, Nyota, never played gin rummy before." Uhura chuckles, shaking her head. She casts him an incredulous expression over the fan of cards held in her silver-nailed fingers. "Sir, you played in gin rummy tournaments with myself and Erica and Christine and Sam on more than one occasion." "Oh, that's right, isn't it?" He huffs a little, squirming in his seat. Around them, the rest of the crew in the mess hall are having a perfectly good time without Spock around. "Long time ago, I guess." "Were we ever so young?" Uhura says wistfully. "Do you know, sometimes I forget I knew Spock at all back then," Kirk mutters. "He was so mysterious to me in those days. I was sure he wouldn't like me. Not that I didn't enjoy the prospect of a challenge." "That's funny, Jim." Uhura so rarely uses his first name since he became captain. The respect is appreciated, but he feels himself physically relaxed at being addressed more casually in off hours, as if they're finally having a real conversation now that she has called him Jim. She folds her cards down on the table and looks him in the eye, the game forgotten. "I remember the day I introduced you to like it was yesterday. And my very first thought was that Spock
and this cocky upstart from the Farragut will get along like a house on fire. I can't say why I was so sure about it, but that's what I thought. The revelation is so pleasing that Jim's hands tingle. He puts his cards down, shaking his fingers out beneath the table where no one will see, but he laughs, smirking at Uhura. Cocky upstart! Is that how you talk to your captain? She doesn't take the bait, and looks at him in a way that makes him feel like that desperate, newly minted youngest first officer in the fleet. I'm just glad I was right, she says. I think you needed each other. Kirk purses his lips. Let me ask you something, he says. He glances around, making sure no one is paying them any attention, but the patrons of the mess hall have dwindled to two quiet ensigns in a corner. A while back, when we were all, under the influence of that virus from Psi 2000, Riley's singing, don't remind me. Spock said something to me then. I've never asked him about it. He glares down at the pile of cards on the table. Don't quite have the nerve. Uhura is clearly shocked, probably at the notion that an action exists which Jim Kirk doesn't have the nerve to try. We were all out of our minds from that virus, Jim. Maybe. Or maybe we were also speaking honestly, the way you do when you've lost your inhibitions. What did he say? She leans forward, breathless. He said when he felt friendship for me, he was ashamed. Oh. I know that for Vulcans, allowing themselves any emotions is considered some kind of failure. But it felt like something else. I don't know. I didn't even think about it until later. There was so much going on. He rubs his face, perhaps attempting to rub some sense into his head. Uhura opens her mouth, closes it, opens it again. I think... Spit it out, Miota. Spock cares for you so deeply, in a different way than I've ever seen him care about anyone, and you understand each other so well. He's my first officer. Jim practically swallows the words. You know it's not just that, Jim. His heart is too loud. It has crawled up into his throat. And what is it, then? There's a drink on the table he forgot about. He drains it. I believe in Terran romantic fiction, Uhura says. You would have been called soulmates. Often on the bridge, Jim leans over to one side in his chair. Sometimes he leans on his elbow. Occasionally, in such a posture, he strokes his own lips with his forefinger as he is thinking deeply about something. When he does so, Spock cannot bear to look at him for fear of doing something mortally embarrassing. Spock is beginning to think Jim has previously gone easy on him when it comes to chess, or his skills have suddenly improved, or, more likely, Spock is distracted during their games as of late, and to a concerning degree. He is never so distracted during work hours or if they're socializing with others, but chess means it's just the two of them. That's always how it has been. Spock looks forward to this time with the captain for the challenge of a worthy opponent, conversations that are either highly stimulating or amusingly banal, and for Jim's easy smiles. But now all Spock can think about is Jim's hands. Jim seems to be having as much trouble as Spock, although he is playing better. He keeps reaching out to make a move and hesitating, his fingers hovering over a pawn or a rook or a bishop, and worse, the fingers of his other hand keep going to his mouth. Humans are such fidgety creatures. How does pinching your bottom lip like that help you think? It is certainly not helping Spock think. You're fidgeting. Jim's voice is unreasonably soft, his eyes still fixed on the chessboard. Spock frowns, only now realizing that his right hand resting on the table has been worrying one of his dispensed pawns between his fingers. So it would seem, is all Spock can manage. You all right, Spock? Jim says. You never fidget. I didn't think Vulcans could fidget. And you're off your game. Quite all right, Captain. But the pawn keeps moving between his fingers. Kirk continues to hesitate before finally muttering, I don't know. He sweeps his knight into an absurd position. So it's both of them playing terribly now. Spock briefly wonders if another mind-altering virus has infected them, or perhaps one that apprehends the ability to play decent chess. Sir? Spock flicks his gaze between the knight and the captain, raising his eyebrows as if to ask if Jim is serious. I can't think straight, Jim says. His fingers prod and pull at his lips. Spock inhales. Is there something particular on your mind? He moves in with his queen. Check. Yes. No. Jim doesn't bother to finish the game. He's lost. You are fidgeting, Spock says. He can't. Look. He stares down at his own hand, which is now incessantly tapping the pawn on the table, a habit he has never exhibited in his life. Is the pull of Jim Kirk so great that he can only manage the stifling tension between them by picking up such annoying habits? That's not to mention the inexplicable degree to which he is giving himself away. He should end the evening and go meditate. He decides he will definitely do that, yet continues to sit and watch himself tap his pawn, amazed. When he glances up, Jim is stroking his bottom lip over and over. As if reading his mind, Jim says, Vulcans have a thing about hands, don't they? I do not think. Jim's hand, the one so recently touching his mouth, covers Spock's own and stills his tapping. Spock loses all his words in the cacophony of his own desire, which is amplified by the same desire in Jim, along with endless adoration. Then his hand is gone, and Spock feels like he has been dropped from a great height. Sorry, Jim murmurs. I'm sorry. His blood is thundering in his ears when he says, Do not apologize to me, and slowly reaches over to nudge Jim's hand with his own, prodding it upwards until they are palm to palm. For a moment they are still. Spock feels all that he felt a moment ago from Jim, and on top of it is astonishment, ecstasy, and some amount of trepidation. He catches a wisp of thought in Jim's mind. He is so beautiful. Experimentally, Jim slowly half clasps their fingers together and untangles them again. Spock sucks in a breath. Under the table, he is very erect, and when Jim presses their fingertips together while staring into his eyes, his lips parted, Spock cannot withhold a tiny whimper that might as well be a thunderclap. In the back of his mind, he feels his bond with T'Pring like a silent figure disappearing into the shadows, but he is certain he also feels from it some sense of relief. Strange. Jim whispers, Spock. The crackle of the computer is jolting, and they mutually jerk their hands back. Captain, we have two unknown ships closing in fast, Sulu says. Came out of nowhere, no response to hails. Go to yellow alert, Kirk says, his eyes wild as he stumbles to his feet, tugging on his tunic. I'll be right there. Something is different. He keeps thinking that the blood fever must not be gone completely. How else to explain that outburst of feeling at seeing Jim alive, which he can't deny to himself no matter what he says to the damn doctor? Spock feels as if some tether of electricity between him and Jim, dormant since they first met, is now buzzing and sparking. He feels both more alive, yet in control, in a way he was not before fighting Kirk in his own backyard on Vulcan. Then there is the question of why exactly the blood fever ended when he thought Jim was dead. McCoy assumes the matter was resolved by the supposed completion of the Khalifi. Spock will let him, and T'Pau, and T'Pring, and anyone else continue thinking so. But it is untrue. He knows it to be untrue, in a way he cannot explain, beyond being pretty sure that you cannot just trick a Vulcan out of an unwinnable plaque tau, like reprogramming an Academy computer. This is a significant puzzle for him, however. Since returning from Vulcan and finding Jim glowingly, beautifully alive, Spock has been in his quarters, researching answers to this question. There is not an extensive amount of research on Ponfar, considering how private Vulcans are about it, but there is some. and Spock knows where to look. There have been odd exceptions and outliers before, other times when the Ponfar was satiated without the taking of a wife or the Khalifi, and without mating. A few exceptions have to do with rare medical conditions. And other than that, Spock can only find two examples that might be at all relevant. 1. Ponfar was satiated when the mate of the sufferer died of natural causes, as if the blood fever took pity on its host. 2. Ponfar was satiated when a mate was found, even if no bond was consummated. The second case is exceedingly rare. A couple of cases where the connection between mates was so passionate and so deep that the mates in question did not need to consummate it physically to satiate the Ponfar. Fascinating, to say the least. Spock is considering the meaning of all this when his door buzzes. He is certain of who it is. His blood feels overly hot in his veins. Enter. The captain is at his door, a tentative smile on his face. But he is wringing his hands, his brow worried as he enters, the door shutting with a soft hiss behind him. "Mr. Spock," Jim says, feathers soft, "just wanted to ensure you know I'm still alive and kicking." Spock rises from his seat. There is a sense of calm and surety. He almost wishes he could convey it to the captain, who is uncharacteristically nervous and does not need to be. Spock is free of his bond with T'Pring. More than that, this liberation has exposed a new bond. He can no longer ignore it. "I appreciate it, Jim." Kirk smiles wider, obviously pleased by the use of his first name. "I thought you might want to talk about..." "No." Spock stands close to him, breathing him in. "No?" Jim blinks at him, adorably befuddled. "A Vulcan doesn't want to talk. What would T'Pau say?" "T'Pau is not in this room." Spock nudges Kirk's left hand with his right, bringing him palm to palm. "It is only you and I no longer wish to talk. Do you?" Their fingers tangle together, and Spock watches Jim's hazel eyes flutter. "Fuck no, I don't," he says, and meets Spock's lips with his own.
"Is that a zebra?" Jim mumbles. The creature in question is clearly not a zebra, as its stripes are pink and yellow. Jim is hanging upside down, having been punished by Edgar, the mostly benevolent dictator running Furthen, a planet which Uhura says is downright wacky, and which McCoy calls a goofy circus planet for absolute blockheads. At the moment, Jim is one of those blockheads, having disrupted the ceremony in question, during which Edgar anoints a new star of the show and does his lion-taming bit. Kirk has been hung by the ankles over the proceedings, where a motley parade of colorful creatures and costumed aliens is currently taking place. He is lightheaded and annoyed that no one has come to free him from the entrapping vines. If he could just raise himself up enough to grab the vines, he could easily free himself, but it has proven impossible so far. At least the planet's climate is nice, the long grass whipping in the wind as a brass band plays a song that Kirk could swear is 76 trombones, but it couldn't be, could it? "Ha! Ha! Back, you terrifying monster! Back! Ha!" Edgar tips his top hat at the cheering crowd in the stands. The terrifying monster looks a lot like an ordinary chow chow to Kirk. It is wearing a red feather boa. Jim is feeling faint. His communicator is on the fritz and his phaser is gone. "For this I went to the academy." All the blood has rushed to his head. The parade finally ends. The crowds leave. Edgar returns to his palatial residence. Kirk is left hanging in the middle of an empty field. He's uncertain how much time passes before Spock finds him. Only visible is an upside-down pair of legs in front of him. Kirk attempts an upside-down sit-up, somewhat weakened from having been hanging for so long, and sees the uncharacteristically pleased and somewhat dazed expression on Spock's face.
Well, hello there, Captain. I believe the appropriate thing to say is, what is a nice Starfleet officer like you doing in a place like this?
Spock! Kirk's hands, at least, are free. He rubs his temples, sighing.
You're high, aren't you? You look high.
Edgar has closed the front gates of his ceremonial field. I was only granted entry if I agreed to eat a Firth and a berry. I believe it has euphoric effects. I'm certain it is an aphrodisiac.
Oh, good. That's just perfect. Can you please let me down now?
Fortunately, I can see that there are only vines holding you in place here. When we transport, you will be freed. However, it strikes me that you are rather vulnerable in your current position.
You don't say. Kirk gasps when he feels cool hands pushing his pants and briefs up past his ass, his cock springing free.
Oh, Jesus, really?
Spock looks down at him, his befuddled Vulcan face rather comical upside down.
No.
Well, I didn't say that now, did I?
There is something about being rendered powerless and at Spock's mercy right out in the open and on a completely bizarre planet in the middle of nowhere that has Jim hard in no time. Spock wraps his lips around Kirk's cock, his tongue curling around him, and Jim clumsily wraps his arms around Spock, mouthing at the tented crotch in front of him. The heat of Spock's mouth, his hands now all over Kirk, running up and down his sides, and squeezing his ass, is enough to keep Jim from holding out more than a couple of minutes, and then he's coming with a yell, his head suddenly dully throbbing, as if his blood is genuinely confused as to where the hell it is supposed to be. His spent cock is hanging out, and Spock is wiping cum from his mouth when he flips open his communicator and says, "Two to transport, Mr. Scott."
"Spock, wait!"
Another planet, another woman, and another opportunity for Spock to wallow in one of his self-made purgatories, as he'd once put it to Layla. He has pushed Jim away yet again, overcome with the certainty that Jim deserves more than Spock can give him. Jim pushes back every time until, frustrated by Vulcan intransigence, they part once more. To his credit, Jim is always able to continue being friends. Or anyway, he is talented at pretending there are no hard feelings during work hours. Then there are the women. Spock frowns and takes another in a series of deep breaths. I acted too hastily. Why do I continually make this mistake? It is illogical, utterly hysterical. His door buzzes, and a shudder runs through Spock as the captain strides in, looking exceptionally agitated. This is it, he's sure. Jim has had it. He will ask Spock to transfer to a different ship. Spock's ability to manage his emotions and his entire hold on logic crumble when it comes to his feelings for Jim, who stands in the middle of Spock's quarters, staring down at him as he sits cross-legged on the floor.
I can't do this anymore, Spock.
His voice shakes. Spock swallows, bracing himself for a terrible pain. How will he ever get over this? He has made a catastrophic error. Maybe he can take leave on Vulcan. A healer may aid him.
Please, please let me come back to you. I don't know how to convince you anymore that you're the only one I want. Then I try to make you jealous, and it only serves to make us both miserable. You're it, Spock, for me. You are it.
I'm exhausted from pretending otherwise.
Please.
Just let me come home to you again.
Spock is on his feet before Jim can finish his sentence, lurching haphazardly into Jim's arms.
I am sorry. I am so sorry. Please come back to me, Jim.
Jim sighs relief into his throat, holding him tightly, their hands reflexively clasping between them.
I will always come back, as long as you will have me, my love.
Dear Christine, thank you for checking up on me. I know you will understand when I say no, I'm not all right at all. Spock is gone, and a sizable portion of my soul is gone with him. I am eating and breathing and sleeping somehow, but I watch it all happen from a distance. It's the oddest feeling. My head has been pounding, though, a constant pulse that won't leave me alone. He is gone. He is gone. He is gone. He asked me not to grieve, an absurd last request which I am unable to honor. He always asked so much of me, and I was only ever grateful for it. But now he is gone, and I don't know how I or the world goes on without him. Jim feels the sum of his love for Spock as he forces himself to wait, patiently, watching this dazed man in Vulcan robes look at him, as if every answer might be found in Kirk's eyes. "Jim," he says slowly, the light of dawn breaking on the face Jim has come to know so well. "Your name is Jim." There is more, and so much more, so much life between them. The moments of triumph and disaster seem infinite. Even in the mundanity, there is a beauty and truth that continues to roll and tumble through their time together. There are thousands of chess games, but only one during which Spock has the hiccups, and Jim can't stop giggling every time Spock endures this indignity. There is the time Jim pretends to like Gaspar to appease Spock, and the time Spock pretends to dislike a bagel and cream cheese, secretly fiddling with the latter-day replicators to get the consistency of the cream cheese just right. There is the era during which they finally share quarters and dress together every morning, and Spock tells Jim to keep his uniform in one piece this time. "Spock, I haven't gotten a shirt torn up in years now," Jim says, as Spock raises a disbelieving brow and steps forward to smooth out Jim's wrinkles. "I sincerely doubt it," Spock says. "I may have to consult the ship's records." Kirk rests his hands at Spock's hips, content to just hold him there and enjoy one of countless mornings together. "You're telling me you can look up how many times I've torn my shirt on missions?" "I am told it is a common search request among the crew." And then both he and Spock, inasmuch as they can tell in this whirl where they stop and start, are tumbling into the nexus together, and the future and past all become an ineffable present, and none of them are fixed, and distantly he hears his own panicked voice echoing in a dimly lit room, from long ago, and from now. Chapter 3.
Spock. Spock.
It was the only word he could say. Kirk's head pounded as he came to himself, the museum library forming around him. He lay in a heap, disoriented, murmuring Spock's name. What year was it? Where the hell were they? The hull breach. The Enterprise B falling into the energy ribbon.
Commander Kirk?
A giant lizard stared at him, looking very concerned.
Commander Kirk, are you well?
Kirk shut his eyes and opened them again, squinting into the soft light.
Spock.
He was 27. He was the first officer of the Farragut. He took a deep breath.
I'm fine. I'm... something extraordinary. I don't know how this could have happened, Commander. This is unprecedented. The stone should have been inactive. And you said you weren't lovers.
I said not yet, Kirk muttered. Kirk sat up on the shiny stone floor of the museum library, rubbing his hands up and down his face, before realizing Spock was on his back, shuddering violently, his eyes wide and fixed on the glowing chandeliers over their heads. Jim scrambled to kneel beside him, grabbing the Vulcan's left hand to hold in his own. Kirk leaned over and held his other palm to Spock's cheek, wet with tears.
Jim, Spock whispered, his teeth chattering. Jim, I can't. It's too much. It's too much. I can't feel all this at once. Please, Jim.
It's all right, Jim said. It's all right, sweetheart. I've got you. He squeezed Spock's hand and shot a stern look at the Bluvian professor. Find Captain Pike immediately. Tell him Lieutenant Spock has been injured. I'm taking him back to the Enterprise. He grabbed for his communicator, flipping it open swiftly. Commander Kirk to the Enterprise, 2 to beam directly to sickbay. The brief wait to beam was interminable, with Spock looking so pale and seizing right in front of him, until finally Kirk felt them dematerialize and the sick bay appeared around them. "Spock!" Nurse Chapel jogged over, kneeling beside them. "What happened?" Kirk helped Chapel and Benga move Spock to a bio bed and didn't miss their questioning looks when Spock again reached out for his hand and Benga ran his scanner over Spock's still shaking body. "We came into contact with a stone on Bluvis with temporal properties," Kirk said. He licked his lips. "Mr. Spock is likely feeling the effects of psionic interference. He is also emotionally overwhelmed by everything he saw as a result of interacting with this stone." Chapel's eyes widened. "What did he see?" "I don't know if I can tell you that." Chapel nodded. "We should sedate him."
"No."
Spock grabbed at Mbenga's tunic sleeve.
"Doctor, mind meld. Stabilize, please."
"You know Vulcan medicine." Kirk nodded at Mbenga. "Can you do a mind meld?"
"By Vulcan standards, I have rudimentary training in the mind meld," Mbenga said, sounding a little too grim about it.
"He will have to help me."
"I will, please."
But Spock's gaze slid over to Jim's.
"Jim?"
"I will be right here when you're done." Kirk squeezed his hand one last time. "You should do this privately." Jim half collapsed into a chair, his gaze fixed on Mbenga as he moved Spock's bio bed into a private room. Chapel was staring at him, and he could hardly blame her. She and Spock had only just broken up their quasi-relationship, and Kirk hardly knew Spock from her point of view. Yet suddenly Spock was clinging to him, like he couldn't stand the thought of them apart. But all Chapel said was, "Are you okay?"
"Glass of water," Kirk said, "would be appreciated."
"Sure thing." Chapel left him for a moment and Kirk rubbed his temples. Everything still felt very off, though he was increasingly less disoriented every moment that passed. There was a sensation of every moment of the future he'd experienced with Spock somehow overlaying the present, which stood out just brightly enough that he could pick it out from the rest and not be confused. Emotionally, however, he too was overwhelmed and just barely hanging on. He could only imagine how Spock was faring. He had to think that some quality of the vision had so affected Spock in particular that his carefully crafted emotional controls were pretty decimated or just haywire. He only hoped a mind meld would heal him sufficiently. Chapel sat down next to him and handed him his water. "I don't want to push, but can you give me some idea of what affected him so intensely? Was it about Michael?"
"No, it was..."
He took a sip of water and stretched his legs out.
We saw our futures. This stone shows you what will be the whole rest of your life. And not just that, you feel everything. Every love or loss. In the course of a few minutes, it's difficult to describe. As you can imagine, it was totally overwhelming. I don't know if it's cruel or kind that, according to the Bluvians, we will both forget what we have learned in a couple of weeks.
My God! Chapel took a breath. That would be intense for anyone. Did we know the Bluvians had this power?
They don't, really.
He got to his feet, suddenly restless, and promptly lost track of his mouth.
It wasn't supposed to work.
It was an ancient ritual for lovers about to get married. You hold the stone, you see the future you share with your fiancé, and you figure out whether it's all worth it. So Spock and I hold the stone, and bam, he and I were... It was so much. It wasn't supposed to work. It wasn't just this future with Spock he was thinking of. Sam, this son he would hardly know before living through his death. Spock dying of radiation poisoning right in front of him. All that grief was roiling in him. And whatever the hell that energy ribbon was. He had to think there was more to that. That something about it had confused the power of the stone, subsequently ending the vision. It was alarming, to say the least, but he hated to worry about some vague danger lying in wait almost 40 years away. Chapel gaped at him. Are you saying that you and he? I'm not saying anything. Kirk raised his hands as if to physically ward off her implication. I'm sorry I opened my mouth. I might be freaking out a little bit myself here. Commander, you and Spock? The way he was holding your hand. Never held my hand like that. I'll bet you anything he never held T'Pring's hand like that. Christine, I swear to God. Christine? She gave a little snort. Okay, Jim. He pinched the bridge of his nose and said, Christine, I know it sounds strange, but I have known you for a very long time. Just not yet. Spock was still shaky, but now gratified to know that M'Benga had undersold his own abilities. With Spock's help, M'Benga managed an effective meld. It would take some concentrated meditation to bring him back to his status quo, but he was stable, and the mountain of thunderous emotions was mostly contained. Though he had no current hypothesis for what might happen if left alone in a room with Jim for very long. Doctor, he said softly, I thank you. You cannot know how much. I am glad I could help, M'Benga said, giving him one more scan to assess his vitals. You are to stay here for the rest of the day, and you are off duty for 3 days, just in case. I don't want you on the bridge or on some damn away mission if there are any surprises. I would argue with you, Doctor, but I will require that time for meditation. And Jim? I need to talk to Jim. Very good, M'Benga cleared his throat. I know I don't have to tell you that anything I saw in that mind meld is strictly between us. You do not, Spock assured him. But again, I thank you. Could you send Captain... Commander Kirk in? Yes. But M'Benga smiled at him, clearly amused. You make a cute couple, you know. I almost feel I should congratulate you. Please do not, Spock said. But M'Benga only chuckled as he made his way out. He exchanged a few quiet words with Jim, who swept inside, shutting the door behind him. For a moment they only stared at each other, Jim leaning on the edge of the bio bed, about to bite a hole through his lip. Yet there was a comfortable regard between them. Spock had sensed Jim's nerves while they'd chatted before touching the unification stone. Suddenly everything between them was different. They knew exactly who they were to each other. Or they would, for the next couple of weeks anyhow. Jim said, You look younger now. How weird is that? I saw you grow older and now you look like a kid. As do you, Spock said. He sat up and pressed the tips of his fingers to Kirk's cheek, lightly drawing a line around the outer rim of his eye. I am fond of the lines you will get here. It means you have laughed a lot. It is apparent that making you laugh will become a great obsession of mine, for all I will deny it. You'll get worse at chess, Kirk said. I allow you to win when you are having a difficult day, Spock said. And you say Vulcans don't lie. Aye. Captain Lupo to Commander Kirk, what the hell happened out there? Is Lieutenant Spock okay? Kirk exchanged a wry expression with Spock and answered his communicator. Long story, and yes, Captain, Mr. Spock is stable. Good. Now get your ass back down here. Yes, sir. He pocketed his communicator again, and Spock barely managed to contain the pang of already missing him. They needed to discuss what they had seen. And besides that, the vague spark of attraction Spock had felt upon first meeting Jim was ablaze. I'll come back as soon as I can. Kirk leaned forward and kissed Spock softly on the lips, as if they did so every day, because it felt as if they did. Paused and kissed him once more. There's so much to... There is... I'm not sure how to pretend to be normal, Kirk said. Also, I feel like I've been demoted again. And what will you tell Lupo, or Pike for that matter? Ah, Kirk shrugged, smiling tightly. Don't know. Jim, You know, we cannot tell them of any future events. I'm not sure about that, actually. He made his way to the door, walking backwards as Spock's brows rose to the ceiling. Plus, you just had M'Benga in your head, seeing everything you just saw, so that's one. That was an emergency, and the rules against tampering with the Temporal Prime Directive are quite clear. They absolutely are not, Kirk said. And we never actually traveled through time. We just touched a rock. Jim. We'll talk about it later. I am going to sit here and meditate in my quarters, and then he is going to come to me, like so many times before and not yet. The thought of Jim's return was distracting, and it was hard not to think of how soon the Enterprise and the Farragut would part. And then you will no longer recall your feelings now. He will again be the charming first officer from the Farragut, but nothing more. That thought was excruciating. Meditation was difficult when he had to keep reminding himself that in a few years' time, Jim would be his captain. They would be together again and only at the beginning of their journey. He frowned, his peaceful contentment disrupted again and again by impatience and anxiety. Spock took a deep breath and resettled himself. With concentration and focus, he was able to meditate much more successfully for another 2 hours before hunger made him stop. He ate a simple meal of lentil stew and was sipping his tea, unable to stop himself from looking up a few choice subjects of interest, like Edith Keeler and energy ribbons, when his door buzzed. It took him long enough. Enter. Spock all but sprang to his feet and strode for the door just as Kirk walked in, and mutually they grabbed for each other, Jim gripping Spock's tunic in his fists as their mouths clashed together. Spock let himself get lost in Jim's kiss until Kirk turned his attention to Spock's throat. I missed you, Jim said. I just spoke to you a few hours ago. No, I mean... Kirk kissed his way along Spock's neck and reached down to hold his hand, doubtless remembering how much that always meant to Spock. Now it feels as if I missed you since I first met you. I keep thinking that I should have known I loved you the first moment I saw you, the moment I stuck my hand out to shake yours like some caveman. Hey, I can feel you laughing at me in there. I am laughing with you. Is that not the saying? He kissed Kirk's collarbone. I don't want to forget this. Nor do I. Spock pulled away and looked Jim in the eye. We will find each other again. We already know this. We will always find each other. This is not sentiment. We have extensive evidence. Spock. Kirk raised his eyes to Spock's, tentative. I told Chris what will happen to him. I wasn't going to. It slipped out, but... He already knew, Spock said. Yes, that is a long story. Then he yelled at me for breaking the Temporal Prime Directive, as he should have. Kirk broke out of Spock's embrace, resting his hands on his hips. I don't agree. I can't. This is different. And what about the integrity of our timeline? You cannot... And what about Sam? What about his wife and son? He whipped around, his eyes already brimming with tears. I just saw him on my way here. He gave me shit, teased me about playing nursemaid to his fainting Vulcan boss, and I almost burst into tears. If you think I will just let this happen, you're crazy. We did not travel through time. We saw a vision from a stone with temporal qualities we know nothing about. That was all. You know I can't just let this happen. To Sam, or to David, or to you. You must let me tell you about the warp drive when... Jim, Spock said gravely. I cannot tell you what to do with regard to your own family. But the actions that lead to my death are too significant to change. I knew you were going to say that. Kirk shook his head, turning away. Please. It is possible that our future will deviate from our vision. Spock reached out, taking Jim's hand again, but Jim would not face him, bowing his head. Maybe it already has, but I cannot take the risk of causing that change. I am feeling everything I will ever feel for you, all at once, Jim said. He sniffed and turned around, tear tracks shiny on his handsome face. It's all I can do not to hold on to you and never let you go and hope I don't forget. Don't make me watch you die again.
You have already seen what happens after Khan's return.
Spock reached up to press a tear away with the pat of his thumb, kissing the spot. I will come back to you, T'Hyla. Jim kissed him softly and nodded.
I'm going to write myself a letter, encrypted, to be opened at some point in the future, maybe after I become captain. I won't include your death.
Thank you, Jim. Spock opted not to reveal that he was planning to write his own letter, warning Jim not to attend the christening of the USS Enterprise B.
Come here, Jim said.
And they kissed again, this time without the interruption of anxieties over temporal tampering or chime-ins from grumpy captains.
Do you think we will remember this part?
Spock thought in Kirk's mind.
If we do,
Kirk thought back, we'll have a hell of a time explaining it to ourselves. Jim licked inside Spock's mouth and nipped at his lips. Spock recalled that he thought of Jim as a hungry kisser before and considered it a Jim Kirk trait rather than a human trait. Jim kissed as if driven to uncover every nook and cranny of a lover, and especially anything that made them shiver, moan, or sigh. That was likely why, with Spock, Kirk often followed up kisses with pressing his fingers to Spock's mouth, or sticking Spock's fingers in his mouth, or pressing their fingers together, constantly looking for Spock's next reaction and happy to focus on his pleasure.
You kiss like an explorer, Spock thought idly.
Kirk sent back no coherent reply, but a flush of bashful pleasure flowed through him into Spock, who became impatient and took Kirk's hand in his, curling his fore and middle fingers around Kirk's and held the gesture between them as they kissed once more. Then Spock felt from Kirk an incoherent sense that if he could love Spock hard enough right now, perhaps they would remember their love.
I don't think that will work, Jim, Spock thought back, but I am certainly willing to try.
Then get yourself over to that bed, mister.
Yes, Captain.
Despite the supposed order, it was Kirk who gently nudged Spock toward his bed, yet kept getting distracted, kissing the beginnings of stubble along his jaw and nibbling his earlobe until Spock pulled him along, stopping when the back of his legs hit the bed.
Get this off, for fuck's sake, Kirk mumbled and pulled Spock's tunic and undershirt up before yanking it over his head.
Though he looked surprised seeing Spock with his shirt off, spreading his fingers along his chest.
You look so different.
I considered greater muscle mass a requirement as a young officer, Spock said. However, as your first officer, I never had the time for such vigorous exercise, whereas you seem uncharacteristically thin at this age. He raised a teasing eyebrow at Kirk's expression of umbrage.
Opposite problem.
Kirk took his shirts off, tossing them over his shoulder, and Spock's hardening cock twitched at the side of his lean frame. I was so busy thinking about speeding up the ranks, I hardly ate a damn thing. And on the Enterprise, those yeomans were always shoving food down my throat.
I myself have something available to shove down your throat, if you would prefer it, Jim.
Kirk blurted a laugh and shoved Spock down on the bed, yanking off his boots and quickly dispensing with his pants. Spock leaned back on his elbows, wryly regarding Kirk, who stripped to his briefs, and stood at the foot of the bed for a beat, rubbing his chin, as if devising his plan of attack.
May I inquire as to whether your strategy is to wait to commence intercourse until you become captain of the Enterprise?
Kirk growled and knelt on the bed, squeezing Spock's ankles before crawling up to straddle him.
You do look different, Kirk said, but you're still just my Spock. You're still home.
And you as well, T'Hyla.
Spock reached up to press his thumb to Kirk's lips and pressed two fingers to his tongue. come here to me. Kirk nibbled on Spock's fingers and turned his head, pressing a tongue kiss to the inside of his wrist. He leaned down and kissed Spock once on the mouth before traveling down to his sternum. I like this spot right here. He ran his fingertips over it, licked the cool skin there, and blew softly, eliciting a shiver from Spock, who ran his fingers through Kirk's hair. He moved to Spock's right nipple. Although I am also partial to this spot right here, he tongued the nipple in question. Spock arched his back and dug his nails into Jim's bicep. Jim moved down just under Spock's ribs to press an ear to the beating of his heart. And this spot right here, the poets might say, that is where you reside, Spock said, resenting the way his voice cracked. Oh, but not you. Kirk smirked up at him. I would never be so Kirk sank his teeth into a soft spot where Spock's hip met his thigh. So sentimental, Spock whispered. And yes, that is where you reside. He sent the thought to Kirk and turned his head, struggling to contain the euphoria he felt when Kirk's response was an explosion of pure sweet feeling that felt like sunshine after a long winter. Jim worked his way down to Spock's cock, but Spock thought, no, no, do not make me wait any longer. Come here to me. Anything you want, Jim rasped and crouched over him, pressing a kiss to his knee. Jim pressed Spock's legs back, and they breathed each other's air as Jim teased Spock's hole with the tip of his cock, pushing lightly before reeling back again, panting as Spock squeezed his thighs around Jim's hips. Again and again, Jim teased with the hard and leaking tip of his cock before rocking back, shuddering. Clearly, it seemed to Spock, Jim was a little too fascinated with his own anticipation, and Spock shook beneath him. He squeezed his eyes shut, mildly infuriated, and heard Jim laughing in his head. He opened his eyes and saw Jim staring at him, his pupils blown, shivering, and half delirious.
Jim.
Spock's jaw was set, his eyes dark as they fixed on Jim, who broke finally and winked before entering him all at once with one hard thrust. Ah! Spock tipped his head back into the pillows and clutched Kirk's shoulders as they rocked, finding the rhythm they had learned to drum together for about 30 years. I will not forget. I will not forget. I will it. Jim, do not let us, please. We will find each other, Jim whispered and kissed away the tears Spock didn't know he'd shed. I will come back to you, Tahila. He held Spock tight. We have already met, Jim thought to him. Is there any doubt we'll love again? Jim and Spock's memories of the Unification Stone were still clear when they were forced to part. The Enterprise headed to a colony on the edge of Federation space near Parnassus Beta, and the Farragut remaining a little longer near Bluvis. Their parting was painful. Spock took the opportunity to speak to the very apologetic Bluvian professor about what they might expect in terms of their memories. But the professor was little help. Some Bluvians remembered everything of their experience except the memories themselves. Others retained little memory at all of those weeks, only finding themselves married and knowing they had chosen their partner with greater knowledge than they now possessed. He was also reminded that this might vary for different species. For their parts, both Kirk and Spock's memories from the stone began to fade rapidly after a week. Spock walked around, having only just bid Jim goodbye, thinking there was something important he was forgetting. He still felt his love for Jim, but there was more, wasn't there? He knew he was beginning to forget, and illogically, even knowing it was inevitable, he kept reminding himself of what he could still remember. He resisted the urge to call up Jim and ask him for every detail of what he remembered. Though they did message often, the both of them were still feeling raw and tender. In meditation, Spock could hardly concentrate at all. Too fixed on thinking of Jim in his arms after returning to Endovid, Jim's mouth pressed to that spot just above his hip, Jim smiling into his neck, the fullness inside him, and Jim scent, his joy, his love all around him. One day, about 2 weeks after he and Jim touched the stone, Spock woke up feeling odd. Spock cleaned up and dressed for the day, but before heading to the mess hall, he said, "Computer, what is the stardate?" "Today is stardate 2344.2. "Is today of any particular significance?" "Today is the festival of Morath's reckoning on the Klingon homeworld, the first day of fertility celebrations on Andoria, the birthday of Vulcan author and philanthropist T'Nahl." "Computer, is today of any particular significance to myself or this crew?" "Clarify." "I cannot." Spock went to breakfast in the mess and was just about to take a bite of oatmeal when Christine sat down next to him, smiling prettily. "How are you?" Spock frowned. "I am not certain. I feel out of sorts, I think would be the correct phrasing." Christine sat up straight, but she did not look surprised. "For the last several days, when I've asked you how you're doing, you've said something like, 'Christine, my status remains unchanged. Please desist in your incessant pestering.'" She affected a parodic imitation of him, but he was in no mood to make an issue of it. "I do not remember saying that," Spock said. "I apologize. It was rude of me." "It's okay. You were having a rough time, I think. Do you remember much of the last couple weeks?" Only now that she asked, did Spock realize the gaping holes in his memory. "I vaguely remember things I worked on over the last week, my duties, but it is blurry. The week before that, there is nothing at all." "Okay," Christine said. Her lack of alarm was irritating. "Do you remember Bluvis?" Spock thought for a moment, and a vivid memory came to mind, walking around the Capitol with Commander Kirk, who kept flirting. Or was Spock flirting? He recalled Commander Kirk acting as if he were flirting, when he had only been speaking honestly, both of their hands holding the stone, and then nothing. "I was at the Museum of Science and Cultural History. That's the last thing I recall. Christine, is there something I should know?" "There is," Christine said. "But you should talk to Mbenga about that. And Commander Kirk." "Kirk, as in Sam's brother?" "Yes." Christine sipped her tea, an amused smile spreading across her face. She winked at him. "Kirk." "Why are you saying his name like that?" Commander Kirk seemed pleasant and engaging the last time Spock had spoken to him, strolling along the sidewalks to the Capitol in Endovid. But speaking to him now was not a top priority, with this issue of memory loss on his mind. Spock reported to Mbenga after breakfast, reporting that he would be a few minutes late to his bridge shift to Pike, who asked no questions and seemed no more surprised than Christine. "I saw my future," Spock said slowly, "and you performed a mind meld on me and saw it all as well." "Not everything," Mbenga shrugged. "Bits and pieces. I was focused on rebuilding your emotional shields and helping you stabilize." "But you are saying that there are things you know about my future that I do not." Spock found himself more curious than upset by the thought. "Yes. And I promised not to speak about any of those memories to anyone, including you."
"Good."
"But later that week, you made me promise you two things." He smiled knowingly, leaning back on a bio bed. He took his pad from the bed and typed something out. "You have sent yourself two letters. The second letter is to be opened far in the future, encrypted for your eyes only. That one is a warning about a future event."
"Impossible."
"Yes, well, you told me you would say so. I also don't know what the future event is, if you're wondering. But I imagine you set up several impenetrable safeguards, knowing you might attempt to stop yourself from receiving it. The first letter I have just sent you, I was to give it to you if you came to me with gaps in your memory in 2 weeks' time, You told me to tell you it contains nothing specific.
Did I say what it was? I would like to have some idea before I dare risk reading it.
You told me it was meant to liberate you from a future self-made purgatory, your words, but it contains nothing that might directly change any timeline significantly. Temporal prime directive, yada, yada, yada.
Self-made purgatory. That was florid of me. What was the second promise?
You are to contact Commander James Kirk as soon as you are able.
Him? Again? He shook his head. Why is he so important?
Mbenga clumsily stifled a laugh that he turned into a cough. Well, he experienced the same thing you did. You were adamant on this point. Read the letter, talk to Kirk. That is all I can tell you.
Spock. I have not addressed a letter to myself before. It is an odd sensation.
By now, you should have spoken to Mbenga and doubtless registered your alarm at the thought of warning yourself of any future events. I will not attempt to persuade myself once again concerning something about which I am already convinced. I will leave that to someone who is better at it and who has a special talent for pushing me beyond what I believe myself capable of. I am only writing to give you some advice for a future that is not written. Having seen some version of it up close, I cannot let slip the opportunity to correct my own mistakes from a reasonable vantage point. You are on the verge of finding your belonging, of finding the very person your sister told you to reach out for. You will fear you do not deserve this belonging, that you cannot give this person what they need.
This is a voice of fear. There is no logic to it, and listening to it is a grave mistake that will waste time and cause greater pain for both parties. Embrace your love, and you will find the balance and belonging you have long sought. You already have it, just not yet. You will live long, and you will prosper. Spock.
Spock wasn't certain just how he knew that the person referenced in this letter was neither Christine nor T'Pring, but he was sure of it in a way Pike might have called instinctual, which was a word Spock preferred to avoid. Yet the fact neither relationship seemed important enough to him to deserve some sacred missive from the vantage point of future knowledge was, in itself, a hard truth. Who, then? Only time would tell, quite literally. He was only too happy to focus on work, having to play catch-up with Sam, resisting the urge to ask him why seemingly everyone wanted him to contact his brother Jim. Oddly, Sam brought Jim up first, but in a way that did not help Spock at all.
"Thank you for your help, Lieutenant," Spock said, after reviewing several lab reports with Sam. "I cannot really explain why I had these memory lapses, though I am told it was a one-time event due to an incident on Bluvis 2 weeks ago. According to Mbenga, I will not experience this again."
"Ah, yeah, I think my brother had something to do with it too," Sam said, leaning back against the countertop and stretching his arm over his shoulder. "He wouldn't give me any details. Weirdest thing. A couple weeks ago, right after those negotiations, he finds me and he's practically crying. Says we gotta be good brothers to each other. He wants to be closer to me. He was so emotional. I felt like a real dick for the brother I've been sometimes, to be honest. We talked a couple times last week. Today I gave him a call just to say hi. He doesn't remember any of that. Like it never happened."
"From what I understand, he suffered the same memory lapse I did," Spock said. "I would not hold him responsible."
It took Spock a moment to realize Kirk had seen his own future, too. Perhaps he had seen something concerning his brother that might make him especially emotional about their relationship, yet now he had forgotten it.
"Lieutenant," Spock said. This was not in his skill set, in the least, but he felt obligated to try. He met Sam's eye. "I cannot explain why, but I believe he was genuine when he attempted to reach out to you. You should assume he would do so again if he could, if he knew now what he knew 2 weeks ago.
Sam frowned, narrowing his eyes. This is some hinky temporal anomaly bullshit, isn't it?
That is one way of putting it, Spock allowed.
All right. I guess there are worse chores than being a decent brother to Jim Kirk, but I don't know many.
Jim's experience was similar to Spock's. He was told to contact Dr. Mbenga, having spoken to Captain Lupo and admitting that he was suffering from a memory lapse. Mbenga filled him in and told him he had written two letters, and only the first could he open now. His letter was much pithier than Spock's.
Jim, you have just met the great love of your damn life. Seriously, there will never be anyone else for you. Don't fuck this up.
Jim Kirk.
Spock let a day pass before he bothered to contact Commander Kirk. He still felt behind in his duties, and as Mbenga had already cleared him and pronounced him to be in good health, the incident on Bluvis seemed only like a bothersome footnote now. He had consulted his own personal logs from the previous 2 weeks. They were void of any detail, yet he heard himself struggling to report banal facts such as what he had eaten for his meals, that Commander Kirk was still on the ship, or that he had just left, and that he could say no more without perhaps revealing too much. It was vexing. Following his evening meal, Spock meditated for an hour, and despite it, he cataloged a vague anxiety about calling up Jim Kirk. But he had promised Mbenga, so he sat at his computer, and in moments Commander Kirk was staring right at him, smiling easily, a lock of his hair falling dashingly over one eye. Kirk's smile faltered for a moment, and he glanced away, as if just remembering he'd left his communicator somewhere. Spock had the same feeling, as if something very important was just on the tip of his mind, or as if he'd lived this very moment before. Kirk met his eyes again, and for a beat they simply stared at each other before collecting themselves.
"Mr. Spock," Kirk finally said, clearing his throat, "I've been expecting to hear from you."
"Yes, I was told to contact you," Spock said, "by multiple people. As I understand it, you experienced the same memory lapse I did while visiting the museum in Endovid."
"Right," Kirk said, sitting up a little straighter. He pushed his hair back.
"I talked to your Dr. Mbenga. He said I saw my whole future because of this fluke with the Unification Stone. So apparently we sat on that for, what, 2 weeks or so?
Then it's all gone. I guess that's for the best, don't you think?"
"I quite agree," Spock said. "Knowing the details of your own future would undoubtedly be hazardous at best. I was surprised to learn that I sent myself two letters concerning the future, however. The first I have read. It was somewhat obscure advice, but I would be foolhardy to ignore it. The second I will apparently receive sometime in the future. It is difficult to imagine warning myself of a significant future event. It is not like me."
Kirk laughed warmly, and Spock recognized he was not being mocked.
"I have had the same experience." He threw up his hands. There was that expressiveness Spock had noted on Bluvis. Kirk wore a smile that was becoming familiar, and in that moment Spock remembered telling Kirk that he possessed a twinkle unique to him in his expression.
"I was clearly accurate in that assessment," Spock thought.
"My first letter was, Kirk shut one eye and pulled a face. "Brief? But it definitely gave me something to think about. In fact, I've wondered..." He blinked at Spock and shook his head. "Well, let me ask you this. I'm told I spent most of every day on the Enterprise after the incident until the Farragut finally left Bluvis, so I find it likely that we spoke..." He gestured at Spock and at himself. "That we must have discussed this, you and I, about what we saw, considering we knew we were going to forget it. We would only have been able to talk about it with each other, and having experienced it together, I think we would have."
"That is a logical conclusion," Spock said.
"Right, and so..." "Well, so I spoke to Mbenga and read Captain Lupo's report, which described the incident.
Obviously, it didn't contain any details of the future we saw, but from what I understand, the Unification Stone was intended for couples about to marry, and we were told it was inactive. The Bluvians were shocked when it activated as the two of us were holding it. Spock felt himself flush. That is correct. Are you two lovers? The professor had asked. Okay, well, have you wondered why it worked on us? Was it a total fluke? Would it have worked on any two people holding the stone, or was it something about us? Commander, I have asked myself the question of why the stone activated while the two of us were holding it 313 times since speaking to Dr. Mbenga about the incident. I have come to no definitive conclusion. Kirk visibly relaxed. That makes me feel a little less crazy then. Well, hell, maybe it works on friends? Maybe we're going to become great friends, and it saw our future and knew that? Spock considered this and tipped his head, reflecting on the notion. Nothing he had heard so far suggested this hypothesis. Neither could it be disproven. But Spock suspected Kirk was offering a kind of amenable resolution they could accept without perhaps overanalyzing a question that might never be answered, or at least not yet. And more than that, he liked Jim Kirk more every time they spoke. That is a pleasant thought, Spock allowed. I would prefer supporting evidence, but that is in short supply. Kirk grinned at him, that ineffable twinkle in his eye. Mr. Spock, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Spock frowned. I have heard this before. It is a quotation, but I have never known its source. It's from a 20th century Terran film, Kirk said, chuckling, called Casablanca. I've never seen it, but people still like to say that line 300 years later, so I guess it must be pretty good. Perhaps next time you are visiting the Enterprise, we may find out for ourselves. Throw a few rounds of chess in there, Lieutenant, and you've got a deal. Agreed, Spock said, and lost track of the smile that slipped across his face. Good. Kirk nodded again and rubbed his lips, but Spock saw the delighted grin he hid. That sounds good. So I should go, life of an XO and all. Very well. I hope to see you soon, Commander Kirk. It's Jim. He winked at Spock, who clenched his fist for a moment where Kirk couldn't see. Jim, Spock said. Yes, right. Goodbye. Goodbye, Spock, Kirk said softly, and the transmission ended. For more than a few minutes, Spock stared at the blank screen and thought about all the possibilities in his future and considered the great likelihood that Jim Kirk might be a significant part of all of them. About 5 years later, Jim leaned on his elbow and smiled, feeling rather like the cat who ate the canary, or in this case, the captain who ate the Vulcan. Spock lay naked next to him in repose, one arm behind his head, his legs tangled in the sheets. He allowed himself a slight smile in Jim's direction. Well, Mr. Spock, I've been captain of the Enterprise for about 48 hours, and so far we've managed to christen my quarters 4 times. Not bad for a couple of days' work. Sir, this is the flagship of the Federation, Spock said. I do not believe not bad is sufficient. I advise we strive for 6. Kirk laughed in his neck and kissed the little spot on Spock's sternum that he liked so much. Let me catch my breath. I don't have Vulcan stamina. Perhaps you should drink a glass of water. You're smug. I do not know what you could be talking about, Captain. He pushed a rebellious lock of hair over Jim's ear. You are twinkling. And you look positively debauched, Jim said, and kissed his shoulder. Your hair is a disaster, and your lips are so dark and full. He pressed a finger to Spock's upper lip and received a nip for his trouble. It's the sexiest thing I've ever seen. Do you possess a mirror, sir? Kirk kissed his chin in response and leaned on his elbow again, tapping his fingers on Spock's chest. Do you ever think about the incident on Bluvis? the Unification Stone. Quite often, Spock said, accustomed by now to Kirk's sudden changes of subject. His mind worked swiftly, often hopping from topic to topic, and Spock was only too happy to keep up. I am sometimes given to ask myself if our lives since then have deviated from whatever future we saw. I know they have. Kirk squinted at him, even more mischievous than usual. How would you know? Spock said. And his next questions piled up on his mind. Had he ever pried information out of M'Benga? Had memories of that future returned to him? Had he already read his second letter? Spock sat up in bed. Your first letter. You initially said it was very brief. Was that not truthful, or... It was about 3 sentences, Jim said, but yes, as usual, you're correct, Mr. Spock. It's because of the first letter that I'm sure the future has already changed. Maybe not too significantly, but I suspect it's, sped a few things up. Jim, what did your letter say? Kirk took Spock's hand in his and grinned. It told me I had just met the great love of my life, and not to fuck it up. Important advice. I've thought of that letter at least once every day since I received it. You cannot mean to say that. Of course I knew it was you, Spock. I knew it immediately. I didn't even have a second guess. Spock nodded as if deeply considering this. As it turns out, my letter said approximately the same, though it was much more verbose. I may have also come to the same conclusion fairly quickly. How quickly? Kirk scowled at him. I suspected my letter was referring to you when I first spoke to you after we lost our memories. Oh, right. When you asked me out. I do not recall it like that. You asked me out to a movie, Kirk said happily. That's a proper date in Terran culture. And Casablanca, I mean, that turned out very romantic. Why didn't you buy me flowers, come to think of it? Do you require flowers, Captain? Kirk burst out laughing and played with Spock's fingers, kissing his knuckles. I just wanted to see your eyebrows do that. Do you know, I've cataloged from you 17 distinct types of eyebrow raises. You finally topped out at 17 a couple of years ago, but I'm certain there may be more on the horizon. We shall see. Imagine what else I'll learn about you. Spock sighed as Jim laid tender kisses along the back of his hand down to his wrist. Only time will tell, Spock said. The future is not written. Not yet, Jim said, and kissed him again. The end.